This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacia. What about those impeachment hearings? They have you questioning your government, huh? Both the followers and the critics of the president have accused the other side of a conspiracy. And underneath it all, the public simmering suspicion of powerful people in high places now reaching a boil. Make a great movie, wouldn't it?
Sure would.
And it will.
It will. Well, this week on Movies on the Radio, exploring films about conspiracies and cover-ups, some allegories, others depictions of real events. They play on our wildest fantasies and all have vivid in illustrations. I would say it, but I can't. Vivid illustrations of the limits of human doubt. As always, joined by film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Marcia, film professor at North Carolina State University and a National Humanities Center fellow. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
You're here once a month, right? I'm noticing a pattern
it's
here.
It's true. It's an over 5 year.
Who put you up to this?
You'll never find out. Our cover is too good.
We're taking tweets. We might even take a phone call. You can hashtag us. You can tweet us at hashtag SOTMovie to join the fun. Well, let's talk about this conspiracy movies, because it really is kind of ideal for Hollywood, right? You're in this liminal state almost the whole time, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, of course, storytelling is what Hollywood has always brokered in, and there's an inherently good story to the idea of a conspiracy or a cover-up. And, you know, it's pretty intriguing to try to puzzle through the line between paranoia and justified suspicion. And all of the great films about this tread that line and make the audience kind of along with the key characters who are often in kind of detective-like roles, even if they're journalists or whatever, try to figure out what's really happening and what the truth is.
And it's also worth noting that the whistleblower is always the hero in these films.
Yeah, right. We don't arrest them, actually. We glorify them in the movies anyway.
That's right. And I mean, you know, it's interesting too to think about when I was musing on the kind of feelings of paranoia and suspicion, how much that was embedded, for example, in film noir, and like just thinking about films like The Big Sleep and The Maltese Falcon, which is like, what even happens in those movies? I don't know. But there is this sense that there are conspiracies afoot and forces kind of conspiring against, you know, the characters.
And that you are a victim, that you're helpless at these conspiring forces.
Right.
Right, right. Because you don't have, there's no symmetry. The symmetry of information. Somebody's got it all and you don't, and you're trying to. And it's almost different than a whodunit in some ways, because you have the feeling of an incremental discovery process. There's an endpoint. Once I get this clue, once I get that clue, the clues are adding up. I know who done it. But in these conspiracy movies, there are a lot of narrators who you don't trust.
But at the same time, you know, if it's a movie about Big Tobacco, Big Tobacco did it.
Right.
There's no question about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
What I also think there's a kind of shift that we see, at least in American film history, which we'll be talking about really today, from that kind of more kind of generalized sense of kind of paranoia and anxiety in some of the 1940s and 1950s films to in this kind of post assassinations of the 1960s, the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, and then Watergate, there's this shift to like, okay, these awful things really do happen. And sometimes, you know, we can even clearly see that the people in the highest position of power in the land, you know, as in Nixon and Watergate, you know, were fully to blame for them. So this was not just some imagined conspiracy. It was a real conspiracy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about those anxieties going pre-Cold War. Your pick, Laura, Keeper of the Flame, is one of the picks. Interesting film.
Yes. This is a movie that stars Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, but it's not a romance and it's not comedy. It speaks very strongly to the fears of fascism in early 1940s Hollywood. And in fact, the author, Donald Ogden Stewart, said that it was the strongest anti-fascist statement that he could make in the Hollywood of the day.
All right, so here's a clip. 1942, it's released, right? Let's listen to a clip from Keeper of the Flame.
This was the essence of their plan. Here are some articles ready for release to stir up all the little hatreds of the whole nation against each other. This was an article to be published in an anti-Semitic paper attacking the Jews. This was to be used in the Farmer's Gazette to stir them up against the city dwellers. Here's one attacking the Catholics, anti-Negro, anti-labor, anti-trade union. subtle appeal to the Ku Klux Klan. Here's a list of newspaper editors who either sought to occupy public office or sought to dictate who should occupy public office. And when they failed, felt that the public was a great stupid beast. Here's a list of men who served their country in the last war and were failures in business and again longed for the power of rank and the prestige of a uniform. In there are the names and addresses of the men who were designated to be America's first stormtroopers. But what was really shocking to me was the complete cynicism of the plan. Each of these groups was simply to be used until its usefulness was exhausted. Hates were to be played against hates. If one group threatened to get too powerful, it would be killed off by another group. And in the end, all these poor little people who never knew to what purpose they were lending themselves would be in the same chains, cowed and enslaved, with Robert Forrest and his handful of power-thirsty henchmen cracking the whip.
The 1942 movie, Keeper of the Flame, that was Laura Boy's favorite.
So this is Katharine Hepburn as the widow of a great man who is actually based on Charles Lindbergh, who many people feared would become president and make alliances with the Nazis. And I came to it, I watched it fairly recently, and when she goes through that speech at the end, which seems so much like, you know, the Republican playbook before the advent of Facebook, it's really shocking that these authoritarian tactics really have not changed over the century.
Well, interesting that it was Republicans in Congress who criticized this film, right? For that very reason.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, they absolutely did, and asked the Hays Commission to in some way censor it.
Right.
I mean, so.
And in a certain way, it has been censored. It's very difficult to see, although I am showing it at the museum in January, so please come.
Ooh, it's now revealed. Let's move on. We'll move on to another listener. Oh, wait a minute. You have more to say about this film.
I do not. Carry on.
Okay, because that was a knowing breath that I thought you were going to take about that film. And Prescient, too. I mean, 1942, as you say. But let's move on to a few decades later, an invasion of the body snatchers.
They're like huge seed pods.
This must be the way that body in my closet was formed. Miles, where do they come from?
I don't know. If they are seeds or seed pods, they must grow someplace on a plant, probably. And somebody or something wants this duplication to take place.
But when they're finished, what happens to our bodies?
I don't know. When the process is completed, probably the original is destroyed or disintegrates.
Scott, no, wait! Sorry, but I take a dim view of watching my own destruction take place.
There isn't any danger until they're completely formed.
We learned that last night at your house.
Your blank didn't change right away.
Not until you fell asleep. Miles, when the change does take place, do you suppose there's any difference?
There must be. Wilma noticed it. So did little Jimmy.
Here we go, from the 1956 film, so only one decade after Keeper of the Flame, the 1956 film Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Marcia Gordon's pick. Marcia?
Yeah, and I have to thank Albert Stagg, my friend and colleague, for mentioning this in one of my social media feeds. It was such a good pick, and this is a film that I hadn't really thought about in this context, and once I did, I thought, God, this is a perfect film to talk about here, because this is a low-budget kind of film noir sci-fi film that takes place in a small California town where all of a sudden people are being kind of replaced by these slimy pod growths that become physical replicants of the people, but mentally they are clearly not them. They're like kind of robotic, and there is this anxiety about, like, wow, they can replace us. And it happened at night. They become you, and you are basically replaced by these pod people. And what's interesting about the film is that because it's so broad, it's such a creepy idea, but it's so unspecific about, like, you know, how is this happening? Why is this happening? And it ends in such an open-ended way that it has been read as a kind of communist anxiety story about communists coming in and taking over people's minds. It's been read as an anti-McCarthyist, anti-Big Brother government. And so it's got this great allegorical quality to it. And it's just, I mean, it's a really, really fun and interesting version of this because it doesn't give answers.
Yeah, and it was in that moment at the peak, or as the Cold War was gearing up, that we were really worried about who's on our side and which side are we on.
And the big question of how do you convince people when you know something awful is happening? How do you convince them? People think you're crazy, right? I mean, that's a kind of recurring trope in all of these conspiracy theory films is that you see evidence of something, but you have to prove it and you have to get people to buy into your theories. Otherwise, you're just the crazy person with a theory.
And you're so vulnerable, too. You know, you have to stay awake or you'll become a pod person.
Yeah, that's right.
And again, the unreliable narrator. We don't know who's on our side because they're all acting kind of normal. And maybe I'm the one who's infected, so I might be the one. Maybe I am crazy. So, yeah, all of that.
Or maybe you're not a person after all, and maybe you're just a shell of what you used to be.
We are talking about conspiracy theories and cover-ups today on The State of Things, Movies on the Radio, with Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and the curator of the Movie Diva series. We've got lots more just ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Anxiety over foreign interference, political assassinations, CIA cover-ups. They may have reached an all-time high with the Cold War tension, but things really have not declined that much. This month's theme for Movies on the Radio is conspiracies and cover-ups. Chime in on Twitter with the hashtag SOTMovie. You can give us a call, too, if you want. We got a plenty full show, but maybe you'll get in. As always, I'm here with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and the curator of the Movie Diva series. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State and a National Humanities Center fellow. Well, you heard of Marcia and Laura's pick in our first segment of the program, and now it's time to hear from you.
My name is Kromit Bob. I'm calling from Raleigh, and I chose North by Northwest as my conspiratorial motion picture. I saw it on TV when I was pretty young, and it really piqued my interest in Hitchcock to the point where I was videotaping every one of his movies when they came on TV. I love the way, in the beginning of the film, as he sort of gets put into this situation where he is essentially framed, they kind of switch things around on him. So when he brings the police to the house where he was held captive, everything's totally different and there are different people there. And, you know, nobody really believes him, any of the stories he's telling. And he's kind of just thrust into this situation where he's an ordinary guy who essentially has to become James Bond.
Are you the Townsend of losing Ben Cove?
That's right. Are we neighbors?
A large red brick house with a curved tree-lined driveway.
That's the one.
Were you at home last night, Mr. Townsend?
You mean in Glencoe?
Yes.
No, I've been staying in my apartment here in town for the last month. I always do when we're in session here.
Oh, what about Mrs. Townsend?
My wife has been dead for many years.
Oh.
Now, Mr. Kaplan, what's this
Mr.
all about?
Mr. Craig and the secretary.
Oh, forgive me, but who are those people living in your house?
What people? The house is completely closed up. Just the gardener and his wife living on the grounds. Now, Mr. Kaplan, suppose you tell me who you are and what you want.
Well, please, just... Look, do you know this man?
He's got a knife! Look out!
Listen to me. I had nothing to do with this.
Call the police!
Quinlan, don't come any nearer. You get back.
From the 1959 Hitchcock classic, North by Northwest. The reason he didn't answer is because he had a knife in his back at that moment.
And that is, of course, Cary Grant as Roger Thornhill. I love this pick, and I love it because it really got me thinking about the fact that so many of Alfred Hitchcock's films could fall under this category of, like, conspiracy and cover-up. The 39 Steps, Psycho, Strangers on a Train, they
Rear
all
window.
That's, like,
yeah.
The great pattern of a Hitchcock film is that there is a character who is either falsely accused, like the wrong man scenario, or, you know, feels like everyone is out to get them because everyone's out to get them.
And nobody believes them.
Right.
Yeah. And they have to. And he's in this case, again, the idea of the ordinary guy, too, who then has to go solve it himself. Right. There's nobody else.
Although taking Cary Grant for an ordinary guy is rather a stretch of the imagination.
In the ideal world, he would be, Laura. But the other thing is that what Hitchcock does so well always is mix that sense of paranoia and anxiety and real mortal threat with great humor and verve. Yeah. And that's the beauty of a Hitchcock film. So he does it the best.
Yep.
Laura, you also picked a Manchurian Candidate, which would be certainly a top candidate.
So many people mentioned it, but I had to be sure and talk about it.
So here's just a clip from Manchurian Candidate. Of course, the idea is these are war veterans, American war veterans, prisoners of war, brainwashed, and then
in Korea,
and then they are, you know, time bombs. Well, here's a clip from that film.
Allow me to introduce our American visitors. I must ask you to forgive their somewhat lackadaisical manners, but I have conditioned them, or brainwashed them, which I understand is the new American word, to believe that they are waiting out a storm in the lobby of a small hotel in New Jersey, where a meeting of the Ladies' Garden Club is in progress.
You will notice that I have told them they may smoke. I've allowed my people to have a little fun in the selection of bizarre tobacco substitutes. Are you enjoying your cigarette, Ed?
Yes, ma'am. Now then, Raymond, take this scarf and strangle Ed Mavoli to death.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Sarge, cut it out. What? Quiet, Ed, please. Now you just sit there quietly. Cooperate.
Yes, ma'am.
Frank Sinatra starred in the 1962 conspiracy thriller The Manchurian Candidate.
But it's about, at the time, Red China, which is one of our traditional enemies, Red, quotation marks,
was
China.
Then.
Yeah. That they wanted to have complete control of the American electoral process. So they...
Foreign interference in an American election. See, this is the thing about conspiracy movies. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Who would do that? Believe it? And, you know, every time I read about Russia, the Manchurian Candidate can't help but come to mind.
Well, what's creepier about this is it was 1962, and of course the trigger is going to happen at a political convention, and a political figure is going to be assassinated. 1962, the film is made. 1963, JFK is killed.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting to think about this film alongside Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which we talked about in the first segment, which was about control of the body, because this is control of the mind, a far more terrifying conceit.
All right, well, let's talk about this, because a lot of the films, especially in the 50s, were very, very deliberately sort of anti-communist.
Right.
It was about the communist infiltration and who among us can we trust, and that kind of paranoia. And then we get to Dr. Strangelove.
My name is David B. Young. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina, and my favorite movie is Dr. Strangelove. It's a movie from the 60s and talks about an insane general who has a conspiracy theory of the Soviet plot of contaminating American water supplies.
Mandrake, have you never wondered why I drink only distilled water or rainwater and only pure grain alcohol?
Well, it did occur to me, Jack, yes.
Have you ever heard of a thing called fluoridation? Fluoridation of water?
Yes, I have heard of that, Jack, yes. Yes.
Well, do you know what it is? Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
That's a clip from Dr. Strangelove, directed by Stanley Kubrick, starring Peter Sellers. David is the one who submitted that one. There we go. But this looks at the paranoia within the military at the time, or a perceived paranoia about those who were afraid of communist conspiracies.
Well, yeah, the whole film rests on Jack D. Ripper, played so wonderfully by Sterling Hayden, one of the voices we heard, having this Soviet fluoridation infiltration theory, but then using that to kind of nuke the Soviet Union without going through the proper channels, a workaround to that. And so it's basically taking legitimate anxiety about nuclear warfare, which everyone was living with at the time, and turns it into this parody by doing something that's not that far from reality, which is to kind of propose that maybe the lunatics are running the asylum, and what happens if they really are crazy.
Slim Pickens riding that missile to Earth. That was a moment in cinematic history, was it not?
And there were close calls with nuclear weapons.
Of course.
I mean, this is something that happened, and actually my late father-in-law worked on a nuclear weapons program, and he felt that nuclear bombs should be used. Otherwise, what was the point of his career? Somebody should have been nuked. That's why we're making them.
Right.
So that state of mind was really just boiling under the surface.
Well, it took a long time for the records to show that the real reason we used, or one of the driving forces for using the atomic bomb in Hiroshima, was just that point, that it would be there'd be no point in having these things if we were the United States. If we hadn't demonstrated we would use them, no one would believe us. We'd better do it now. And that was what convinced Harry Truman that yes, we need to do this thing. It was not about how many sailors we would lose, as the record now shows. Well, the record is still quite open on the JFK assassination, though for the record, the congressional investigation does show that it was a conspiracy, but still, people don't know this. And then speculation about the Kennedy assassination lives on even today.
My name is Brett McCabe, and I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland. I want to talk about Executive Action, a 1973 film about the CIA and big business plotting to kill John F. Kennedy. This is like the basic plot of JFK, but like 15, almost 20 years earlier, and it's a what I love about this film is that it's just already, you know, in the early 70s, so weirdly paranoid about, you know, who killed JFK. I'm not somebody who ever thinks we're going to know that answer, but to see it kind of play out in a movie that looks like something as dated as The Exorcist or Serpico is just so very entertaining to me.
At this point in time, can you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President John F. Kennedy by himself? Don't make your decision until you see Executive Action, possibly the most controversial motion picture of our time.
Start the target.
A film that nobody would make until now.
Fire! Probabilities for success are almost 100%.
They're like a day of pigs.
Now, look, you're a high-risk man. You're on contract. Your men are all experienced in black operations. You take your chances and you get paid for it, and damn well.
A story built on long investigation and careful deduction, fitting together the missing pieces in the most important and tragic murder of our century.
The ludicrousness of the film just kind of stands out, even as it kind of hits all your paranoid buttons about, yes, the JFK was doing this, that, and the other, and we're never really going to know what happened.
Talking about the 1973 film Executive Action, starring Burt Lancaster.
Well, I'm sure you will attest, Frank, you were a kid too when Kennedy was assassinated, and it was a national trauma like no other. And we've been looking for a reason why our entire culture pivoted on that moment.
Mm-hmm. I read a 1973 review of this film that Vincent Canby wrote, and he accused it of turning one of the most awful incidents in American history into this kind of silly, reckless melodrama. And I thought that was an interesting contemporary critique of the film. It does use kind of both real and fake newsreel footage. And so there were, I think, reasons to have that anxiety. But I'm really glad that Brett mentioned the Oliver Stone film from 1991, JFK, which it's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember as one of the most delirious, frenetic conspiracy kind of movies that I have ever seen.
What gets wacky is, as I say, the congressional report that followed that was in the mid-1970s, Congress did reopen the investigation and concluded that it was most likely a conspiracy. And most Americans don't know that. People are right now saying, what? They go look it up. The congressional investigation into JFK's assassination concludes it was a conspiracy, that Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone. He was alone in the book deposit, et cetera. You can look at that. Well, what's interesting about it is, so now the final record says it is a conspiracy. If you didn't know that, you know, shame on you. But what gets wacky is when you decide to tell the story of who was involved, because the congressional report says we don't know, and how and why it all took place. That's when you start going on a flights of fancy and sound like a lunatic.
Well, and then when you add to that Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and right, then you kind of create this whole decade of loss and whodunit, the great whodunits and whys, and how history would have been different had it not happened.
Movies on the Radio, conspiracy flicks today.
My name is Gregor Meyer, calling from Raleigh, and my conspiracy theory film of choice is The Parallax View, starring Warren Beatty. Unlike a lot of conspiracy theory movies, this one really puts the audience in the point of view of the main character. There are lots of shadows and scenes with very little lighting because he's in the dark, we're in the dark. There are lots of silences where normally there would be movie music. You see how there's ongoing maintenance required for those acts like assassinations.
Now, why are you here this time?
I told you, somebody's what? Trying to kill me.
Oh, Jesus. Somehow I don't think I should be looking at this.
Just look.
Oh, come on, I looked at this now. I was blue in the face 3 years ago.
Since the assassination, six of these people have died in some kind of an accident.
Four. Look, nobody's trying to kill you, huh?
These people were killed. And whoever killed them is going to try to kill me. Austin Tucker thinks so, too. Austin thinks that maybe we all saw something up there.
Yeah, well, we did see something up there, didn't we?
No, I mean something else.
Well, what do you mean by something else? Does he ever indicated what he means by that? Has he ever indicated to you that he saw anything other than what was in the commission report?
No.
Nothing?
No.
Did you see anything up there?
No.
Well, neither did I. And believe me, I looked. We all looked.
1974 film The Parallax View, starring Warren Beatty. Movies on the Radio today talking about conspiracy films and cover-ups.
And the thing that's interesting about this movie is that you expect that the hero is going to eventually figure out what the solution is, but because it's a downbeat 70s movie, he only figures out partway and only enough to put himself in danger.
And I want to just briefly mention another film from 1974, The Conversation, a Francis Ford Coppola film with Gene Hackman, because it's brokering in similar ideas about surveillance and things not being what they seem. And I think that is a film that really was so ahead of its time in terms of thinking about the way we monitor and the information that can be understood and not understood through that process.
Well, that gets us to our next film, because most of these have been about individuals in powerful positions covering up, and now we move into the era where culture itself is the villain.
This is Adam Hewlin. I am the curator of Cinema Overdrive at the Carolina Theater of Durham and the Alamo Drafthouse Raleigh, and I live in Chatham County. And my pick for a conspiracy film is Videodrome by David Cronenberg, and this was a film that was made primarily because of Cronenberg's interest in the predictions of Marshall McLuhan, which was a fellow back in the 70s who was predicting the coming of what we now know as being the internet and the globe being connected through technology. And in Videodrome, they use video signal to almost create a hallucinatory state from people who watch this signal. And James Woods plays a sleazy cable TV producer named Max Wren, who has a cable TV station in Toronto, and he's looking for harsher and harsher content to put on the airwaves. And he slowly but surely gets sucked into this conspiracy that is about, mass mind control.
Why? To get you involved. To expose you to the Videodrome signal. It didn't affect you because you never watched it. You knew what was there. You didn't have to see it. It really does work on just about anybody.
Anybody who watches it, Max. But why would anybody watch it? Why would anybody watch a scum show like Videodrome? Why did you watch it, Max?
Business reasons.
Sure. Sure. What about the other reasons? Why deny you get your kicks out of watching torture and murder?
Once he gets infected with the Videodrome virus, if you want to call it that, he winds up becoming very passive and goes along with just increasingly weirder and weirder scenarios. And he's trying to figure out what's going on, but he never really fights against it. And then by the end of the film, he's just a broken man.
1983 Canadian cult classic Videodrome.
So I saw this film for the first time as a graduate student in the 1990s, and I remember thinking it was really out there and edgy and pushing all these boundaries. And now I look back at, it's 36 years ago, and I think Cronenberg, who also wrote this, so these are his ideas in the film, He was so ahead of his time in terms of thinking about the way that signals, I mean, it's not VHS, but the way that signals and media have literally consumed us and are controlling us. It is really extraordinary. And I think about there's this one very unforgettable scene in the film where James Woods comes together with a television, the big lips on a television, and just that merging of people with technology. It's kind of a version of Ready Player Go, but more disturbing and Cronenberg.
And earlier, we're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about it. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laurel Boys, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia, by the way, hosting an event exploring how science is portrayed in popular cinema from 1902 to the present. Science in the Movies, the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences next Thursday, November 21st at 7 o'clock. That's on our website, and there is more. By the way, the Movie Divas series, Laurel Boys, screening at the Carolina Theater in Durham, Mark Lawrence's Music and Lyrics. That's Wednesday at 7. All of it's at our website, stateofthings.org. And there's more movies on the radio just ahead. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things Movies on the Radio this month, talking about conspiracies and cover-ups. Here's one.
My name's Dwayne Scott. I live in Garner. My favorite movie is 3 Days of the Condor. One reason that it's my favorite movie is I just got my driver's license in about 1973 when the Arab oil embargo was taking place. And, I watched the big, long lines of people trying to get gas. And, the price of oil went up like 400% during that time. In the movie, the basic plot is that Redford's character, Josh Turner, was working for the CIA. And long story short, he discovers a plot. He's not sure what it is, but in the end, it turns out to be a shadow CIA organization that are practicing war games in case they ever want to start a war for oil. The main point of it is that you've got Cliff Robertson's character in a conversation with Robert Redford's character, and he's saying,
"It's simple economics. Today it's oil, right? In 10 or 15 years, food, plutonium, and maybe even sooner. Now, what do you think the people are going to want us to do then?"
"Ask them."
"Not now. Then. Ask them when they're running out. Ask them when there's no heat in their homes and they're cold. Ask them when their engines stop. Ask them when people who've never known hunger start going hungry. You want to know something? They won't want us to ask them. They'll just want us to get it for them."
The 1975 film 3 Days of the Condor, starring Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. Now, there's a film, too. Remember, 75, by now, not only is it Watergate, but the CIA and FBI, COINTELPRO, were starting to realize more and more about domestic spying on our own people, on our own political activists. Everybody's under suspicion at this moment.
So many of these films tap into that fundamental fear of not just who can you trust, but what if you really can't trust, your government, right? The people who are supposed to be policing you. And there are very legitimate reasons for feeling this that come out of this time period and that continue to bubble up today.
And I mean, in the hearings yesterday, when he talked about that there was the regular channels and there were the irregular channels or whatever, this is a complete echo of, this shadow CIA in this film.
So there were some very serious films about some very serious issues, and then there was this.
"Hi, my name's Carlos Case. I live in Wilmington, North Carolina. And my favorite conspiracy film or conspiracy-related film is a movie with a pretty wacky title. The complete title is Tribulation 99. Alien Anomalies Under America, The Shocking Truth About the Coming Apocalypse." It's a mouthful, and the film is kind of similarly zany. It's a kind of parade of really outrageous conspiracy theories woven together by this guy who's whispering a kind of frantic narration, like a paranoid whistleblower trying to tell you something before he gets caught.
"A thermonuclear war 1,000 years ago blasts the planet apart into the billions of pieces that form the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Despite massive genetic damage, an elite core of Quetzals managed to escape in their disc-shaped spacecraft to Earth."
He's frantically whispering this narration, telling us about the connection between the American government, the CIA, Latin American dictatorships and aliens. And so there's this incredible, I guess, like this assault of mixed conspiracy theories that combine some degree of truth with an incredible degree of outrageousness. And that's why it speaks to something about the real world, that, you know, the American government did try to kill Castro, and it did overthrow Allende in 73, but it didn't overthrow Allende because it's trying to stop the earth from spinning, which the film suggests.
There we go. 1991 film, Tribulation 99.
I think this is a really brilliant film made by a totally radically independent filmmaker, Craig Baldwin. It's a short. This is not a Hollywood film at all. And it's a found footage compilation documentary as well. So it's using these fragments of the reel to create this kind of madcap uber critique of conspiracy theories. And so I'm very grateful that somebody called in to talk about it.
Yeah, I don't really have the bandwidth to take alien conspiracy theories into my brain. It's like, I have a lower kind of concern about that.
It depends on your definition of alien, of course, because there are people who are born right here who you think came from another planet. But the other thing is, it's 1991. This is the birth, this is the rise of the age of irony, right? This is the time when we're being meta and uber about our own fears, and we're not taking anything as seriously as we might have in the 70s. I mean, it's interesting to see the way conspiracy is treated, at least in this particular film, in a very independent film.
Although I would say in some ways this film is no different than Dr. Strangelove. It's very different.
All right. Let's wag the dog. One of your other, you are just, you're paranoid.
Yes,
Laura.
I am, because Wag the Dog is another film that seems to actually be, it's being used as a playlist, you know, for the current political situation.
And one that was that was prescient about a president who just would start a war in order to take care of his own political problems. Would Bill Clinton ever do that? Let's listen.
Just got to distract him. Got less than 2 weeks till the election.
What in the world would do that? What in the world would do that?
Well, I'm working on it. The Gulf War, smart bomb falling down a chimney, 2,500 missions a day, 100 days. One video of one bomb, Mr. Moss. The American people bought that war. Mm-hmm. War is show business.
You want me to produce your war? Not a war, it's a pageant. We need a theme, a song, some visuals. We need, you know, it's a pageant.
It's a pageant.
It's a pageant, that's what it is.
Country's a war.
It's Miss America in your bird parks.
Why Albania?
Because.
Well, they have to have something we want.
Well, sure they
do. What do we have that they want?
Freedom.
Well, why would they want that?
Oppressed?
No. Freedom. They wanna destroy the godless Satan of the United. They want to destroy our way of life, all right?
Albanian terrorists have placed a suitcase bomb in Canada in an attempt to infiltrate the bomb into the USA.
From the 1997 film Wag the Dog.
And it's about constant distraction.
Yes.
You know, that you can say anything. Don't ask me about the B-3 bomber. What B-3 bomber? There's no B-3 bomber. That's right, there's no B-3 bomber. And it's a complete sort of stew of distraction and fallacy and fantasy that people accept as true.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine politicians being imagined as unembarrassed liars who believe the public is so stupid that they'll believe anything they say.
Yeah, but the public wouldn't be so stupid. Well, let's move on now. Movies on the radio. But the other thing about it, and it takes you back to Videodrome, which is that we can actually produce this thing. I can create an entire scene. And because we are now so plugged in, and I'm not sure it would have worked several decades ago because people had other ways of gaining information. But now the only way you have is through that screen. I can give you a world and you absolutely will believe it. 40% of America believes in, you know, the numbers are startling.
Right.
Well, we do have films that took on, in this case, Wag the Dog, of course, ended up being about a very prescient about what was going to be a political topic. It didn't know it. Erin Brockovich is a film that did.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Foley Walsh, and I'm in Oxford, North Carolina. I still find the movie Erin Brockovich from 2000 to be inspiring and pretty relevant today. I remember when I first saw the film I didn't realize that Julia Roberts was really playing the role of a true person named Erin Brockovich and showing us a dramatization of a true story that happened about a legal clerk who played a vital role in exposing a cover-up. This was a cover-up of leakage of hexavalent chromium, which was a big word for a young person, but that was something that the movie brought out, and apparently the drinking water contamination in the town of Hinckley, California, was the center of this movie, and Julie Roberts showed how the real Aaron Brockovich was instrumental in building a successful lawsuit, ultimately, against PG&E in California.
Let's be honest here. $20 million is more money than these people have ever dreamed of.
Oh, see, now that pissed me off. First of all, since the demur, we have more than 400 plaintiffs in. Let's be honest, we all know there are more out there. They may not be the most sophisticated people, but they do know how to divide, and $20 million isn't shit when you split it between them.
Aaron.
Second of all, these people don't dream about being rich. They dream about being able to watch their kids swim in a pool without worrying that they'll have to have a hysterectomy at the age of 20, like Rosa Diaz, a client of ours, or have their spine deteriorate like Stan Bloom, another client of ours. So before you come back here with another lame-ass offer, I want you to think real hard about what your spine is worth, Mr. Walker. Or what you might expect someone to pay you for your uterus, Miss Sanchez. Then you take out your calculator and you multiply that number by 100. Anything less than that is a waste of our time.
From the 2000 film, the biographical film, Aaron Brockovich, directed by Steven Soderbergh and starring Julia Roberts.
Well, we've talked a lot about political cover-ups, but there's a whole genre of corporate cover-ups as well. Aaron Brockovich talks about PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, going through another series of problems right now. Mm-hmm. And there's also The Insider with Russell Crowe about the tobacco industry. There's a civil action with John Travolta about other environmental
China
problems.
China syndrome.
All of these things where you think it's hard to protest against the government. These corporate entities have complete and utter power over their domain.
And, you know, frankly, it's nice to see films every now and again about individuals that can make a difference face of all of this, because so many of these films are just like, okay, my God, it's overwhelming. There's no answers. Right. And then you get a film like this, and oddly enough, maybe also All the President's Men, about journalists making a difference. And we need those stories to remind us of why it's worth fighting.
My name is Dana Stone. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina, and the film I would like to talk about is based on a true story, a frightening true story involving a huge cover-up in Boston, and it involved the abuse of children by Catholic priests, and I hadn't realized this before, but the Boston Globe has a special unit called Spotlight, which is made up of extremely talented journalists who go all out to get to the bottom of a story.
So you believe the church is aware of the extent of this crisis?
Oh, absolutely. After the first major scandal in Louisiana, Tom Doyle, the secretary canonist for the papal nuncio, co-authored a report warning pedophile priests were a billion-dollar liability. That was in 1985.
1985?
That's right.
Who saw that report? Anyone from the Catholic hierarchy?
Sure. Doyle tried to introduce the report at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. In fact, Cardinal Law initially helped to fund the report, but then he backed out and they shelved it.
Are you kidding?
Richard, Robbie here. We think we have 13 priests in Boston that fit this pattern, which would be a very, very big story. Does that sound right to you in terms of scale?
No, not really, Robbie. Sounds low to me. My estimates suggest 6% act out sexually with minors.
6% of what?
6% of all priests.
How many priests do we have in Boston?
About 1,500. 1% is 15. 6% is 90.
Wait. 90 priests.
Is that possible?
From a metric standpoint, yes. That would certainly be in line with my findings.
From the 2015 film Spotlight, Movies on the Radio today with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon.
And let's salute the freedom of the press.
That's right.
The journalists are so often the heroes of these films.
And, I mean, this story is so well told in terms of the discovery and persistence and investigation and reporting. And whenever we see people in a position of absolute authority taking advantage of that authority, we absolutely need people who are going to pull back the curtain
yeah.
and
And once again, a success story.
Exactly.
So, you know, there is hope and there's a reason to keep putting your shoes on every morning.
My name is Lynn Taylor, and I'm calling from Raleigh. I actually had two sets of movies that I recommended. The first one that I thought of on the government plot theme was 3 Days of the Condor. I also said that I loved the Jason Bourne three movies that I've seen so far. And it was not until I went and looked at 3 Days of the Condor again that I realized how many parallels there are in some of the plots. Both movies have drama and plots that are interesting, the government cover-up.
Okay, I'm up. We're getting grids. Airline, train, hotels,
just get
hospital.
The address, the street.
Kevin Scheif.
Here we go. I got it. I think I got it.
Is it him? Unreal.
38 minutes ago.
Hey, Zurich police are looking for an American man carrying a red bank bag.
He just tore up the embassy and he put two cops in the hospital last night.
Get everybody up. Do it now. I want them all activated.
Wait, all of them at the same time?
You heard me. I want Bourne in a body bag by sundown.
All right, let's get a map up here. Come on, folks. Work it.
And also the fact that in the 70s, I think we were just starting to wonder, like, wow, right after Watergate, maybe there's more going on with government cover-ups than we realized, or maybe that's just the age that I was then and the age that I am now. But now I think it's totally believable that there might have been a cover-up of some kind and we never learned about it.
That was the 1975, the Bourne Identity, but the series, of course, has gone on.
Yeah, and I mean, and this is a great thriller series. We haven't really used that word, I don't think, so far in the show. But I mean, that's what so many of these films are. And that also has shades of North by Northwest, I think, with the identity and confusion about who he is.
A little more adrenaline.
A little more adrenaline.
Earlier films.
Yes.
Next month, we should talk about dancing, don't you think?
I think December is dancing month.
Let's dance. Don't ask me. So films about dance, it can be, of course, musicals, but a particular kind of musical. And
could
of course,
be documentaries.
Dance films. Documentaries about dance. Lord of the Dance. We'll do that. We'll dance with our hands at our sides. That's what we're going to do next time. So, you know, use the usual channels. Join us on the State of Things. Movies on the Radio. Next month, we'll talk about dance. Marcia Gordon's going to host Science in the Movies at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences next Thursday at 7. Also co-editor of the new book, Screening Race. It'll be showing, she's going to be showing an accompanying collection of short 16mm films from the 60s and 70s. And Laura Boy is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva series. What are you doing? You've got something coming
Victims
up.
Of Sin, a Mexican film from the Golden Age, directed by Emilio Fernandez, Sunday at 2 p.m.
All right, and that's where?
North Carolina Museum of Art.
So you heard it all. There's even more. Go to our website, stateofthings.org, a program that is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnuson, Grant Holub-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Tarr is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.